welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
So, what were the biggest stories on television, in the papers, shouting from magazine covers in the past couple of weeks? In America, in Australia, worldwide. Third, I'd guess, Iraq and its dire consequences. Second, climate change and the possible end of civilization as we know it. Top, number one by miles, was a melange of Britney's shaved bonce and Anna Nicole Smith's messy exit. At one stage in America, where I've just been, three stations on three separate TV sets were showing Anna Nicole revelations at the same time. By the way, I'm the real father of the child, not those other 32 guys. This is one aspect of what Shelley Gare calls the triumph of the airheads, the way it doesn't pay to be skilled at work, committed to science, or in any way serious. Another aspect is the fate of the donut, Shelley Gare.
The other day, a friend, an investment banker, sent me a quote for our Times. It was from a new novel, and it went like this. The great spiritual benefit of the Krispy Kreme original glazed donut is the sensation of nothingness. This American donut that has squidged its way around the world looks like something, but in fact it is nothing. It promises everything, sweetness, fullness, pleasure, but once in your mouth, it disappears. I identified, not because I eat donuts, but because I believe that nothingness, dressed up as a big, fancy, impressive, desirable something, is turning out to be the fatal flaw in our easily impressed and increasingly airheaded age. In late 2000, one of our major banks brought in the giant management consultancy business, McKinsey & Co., to help define and refine its corporate culture. It used something called CTT, or Cultural Transformation Tools. In the first 2 years alone, when only senior staff were put on the program, the bank spent a reported $16 million. Over the next several years, the rest of the bank's fast staff went on it too. In the initial period, the program had to help everyone decide on a set of values that the bank and its staff could share. These turned out to be put the customer first, perform and grow, lead and inspire each other, earn the trust of the community. Am I the only person who thinks it's seriously weird that a major bank and about 25,000 of its staff needed someone else to help them work out these should be their values? It makes me want to talk like an airhead, like, duh. The challenge of the 21st century is not how to turn a sow's ear into a silk purse. It's how to pretend that something that is nothing is actually worth something. Londoner Jade Goody spent most of 2001 broke and was later evicted from her council flat for unpaid rent. In 2002, she was one of the housemates in the UK edition of Big Brother. By 2006, she was worth more than £2 million and had her own perfume. She said honestly of her sudden good fortune, "When I'm on the front of a magazine, I sell more copies than Victoria Beckham does. That is an amazing thing to be told, and I think it's a massive achievement for, I don't know, doing nothing." These days, nothing is the new something. Well, it's not, of course, not if you still have your wits about you, but it's certainly what we are being coaxed, encouraged, and driven to believe. Something nothing is there in the empty speak of rampant managerialism, although saying that to your boss might be a career-limiting move. It's the new style of accountability which allows high-profile business people and politicians to get up on witness stands and give non-answers like, "I don't recall," and "I don't remember." It's universities running courses like gender studies, media studies, and sports management, and building up their schools of business studies, while the core disciplines of maths and science go begging for resources, teachers, and students. Something nothing promises so much, and for so little real effort. It is the perfect instrument for our spin doctoring, short-term thinking, quick fix, bottom-line-driven era. Just wait and see how much something nothingness ends up infiltrating the conferences and decision-making on global warming. Right now, there's a thriving new industry in teaching people how to think. What was once acquired through years of study, reading, analysing, debate, and observation can now be got apparently from attending a few seminars. Phew, just as well for that. Companies bring in thinking consultants to teach staff how to strategize, order their thoughts, think laterally. One such consultant told a reporter how she had got the staff of a water utility company to do a word association test. The staff were worried about water contamination. She said elephant randomly, and instantly she said they thought of trunk and the idea of having water in reserve for emergencies. Again, I want to say, duh. Was this staff just humouring the consultant and their bosses? Never underestimate how much common sense the average person has. As per that wonderful TV series, The Office, it's the ones above we have to worry about. Meanwhile, whole businesses, careers, consultancies, branches of academia and areas of specialty turn out to be something nothing. Take psychometrics. Not many new employees get hired, or even through to job interview stage these days, without being subjected to some form of psychometric testing. Often, to add insult to injury, it's done by computer. Candidates fill out a series of questionnaires that are supposed to test not only their cognitive, mathematical, and verbal skills, but also give insights into their personality and whether or not someone is a team player. It's supposed to speed up the selection process and give some kind of scientific precision, and yet researchers acknowledge that it's very difficult to work out whether psychometrics does pick the most productive employees. The literature on the subject is minimal and mostly critical. Dr. Alison Wolfe of the Department of Management at King's College in London has researched the field thoroughly. In one paper, published in Human Resource Management Journal in 2006, she and her co-writers say, "Continued growth in test use is likely, but the implications for efficiency and selection are less clear." In an email to me about psychometric testing, Dr. Wolfe said, "I am frequently amazed by how many things we do which have no evidence base at all, or a negative one. And I did talk to a couple of very experienced recruiters who had grave doubts about the whole thing and thought it basically meant you just ruled out anyone who wasn't straight down the middle in personality. But how do you find out if someone would be any good if they aren't hired? A non-researchable question." So here we are, this rapidly growing industry, which is increasingly seen as indispensable and which provides massive consultancy fees or jobs to a growing bunch of so-called psychometric experts, and it's poised on one toe and balanced on what? Well, nothing really. Managerialism is another case study in something nothing. It seeped into our consciousness in the 80s alongside the idea of the market-driven economy. Now it is a vast semi-cult, taking up meters of space on bookshop shelves, commandeering course time in universities, and infiltrating organisations the way Legionnaire's disease goes through air conditioning systems. Managerialism argues that management is really a science, and to get a business running well and profitably, all you have to do is apply a set of principles. If you can run a bottling plant, you can run a pharmaceuticals company. Economist John Quiggin explained in his blog, johnquiggin.com, in mid-2003, how managerialism really works. He wrote, and I quote, "The main features are incessant organisational restructuring, sharpening of incentives, and expansion in the number, power, and remuneration of senior managers with a corresponding downgrading of skilled workers, particularly professionals," ends his quote. Now there is the real danger in something nothing. With its promise of easy fixes and fast profits, it undermines specialist knowledge and devalues experience. It mocks the belief that expertise and skill come from practicing a craft or profession and from watching other experts. It says every industry is like every other industry and that managers always know best. Naturally, much nonsense can result. When the BBC's Director General, John Burt, brought in management consultants to the corporation in the early 90s, they introduced the idea of the, quote, internal market. Departments had to become business units which sold their services to each other. The rise in paperwork and bureaucracy was phenomenal. Author Neil Glass described it in his book, Ripoff, The Scandalous Inside Story of the Management Consultancy Money Machine. He reported that within 4 years, the corporation had fewer staff, more red tape, and an administration bill that was confoundingly £140 million higher. Management consultancy fees had run to £20 million a year. The Guardian newspaper delightedly wrote up one story. The BBC's record library used to loan out recordings to producers for free. Under the new system, it started charging so much that producers found it cheaper to nip to the local record shop. The newspaper commented, "If a record is popular, 20 different departments or stations now purchase their own copy, a method of money-saving which Lewis Carroll would have adored. In fact, management consultancies are supposed to have a success rate of around 30%, about what you get in any new project. In the last few years, there have been big changes at our CSIRO, with the arrival of CEO Dr. Jeff Garrett. During his time at the helm, the numbers of highly paid management positions have risen sharply. In the 2004-2005 annual report, there were 5 executives earning over $320,000. The next year, there were 9, and in the 2006 report, there were 12. Senior research scientists, though, are on between $100,000 and $120,000. In the 6 years to June 2004, while corporate positions were doubling, 316 people went from research projects. The president of the CSIRO staff organisation, Michael Borges, remarked to me, "The mechanic has become more important than the creator." That comment ties in with an observation by one-time American Republican Kevin Phillips in his recent book American Theocracy. In that examination of the forces now shaping the United States, Phillips described the financialization of the economy. By that he meant a move away from a manufacturing economy to an economy based on nothing more than moving and managing money, on doing deals. It's a dramatic shift in sensibility. In the old manufacturing-based world, the one that most of us are used to, work was about the act of creating something tangible. That is, there was nothing, and then there was something. Furniture, clothes, cars, books, films, music, buildings, pipes, electricity, crops, scientific discoveries, radio programs. Now, all of that still goes on, but it's not where the action is. That's in the financial services sector, and in the massive amount of time now spent on, well, doing deals, mergers and acquisitions, real estate, insurance, arranging financing, moving money, collecting percentages. That's what is fueling the vast salaries and bonuses in that sector. And as the Australian Financial Review reported in a late 2006 survey of executive salaries, financial engineers now dominate the top-paid lists. That's why so many of the bright students who might have taken careers in science and maths are streaming into the financial engineering sectors instead. Finally, I must note that the bank that spent so much on cultural transformation now reports the highest staff satisfaction levels of any major Australian company. Oh, you might think, its program has been successful. But the bank has also introduced a raft of concrete staff measures like better staff benefits, doubling parental leave, sorting out childcare, offering free health checks every 18 months, and giving staff over 55 the option of working part-time. I know what I think has given the bank its improved satisfaction levels, and I wonder how many inside the bank, doing the sums, have dared say the same thing. Let's not forget the end of the story, The Emperor's New Clothes. The emperor, togged out, supposedly, in his magical finery, heard the little boy's jeers, "He's not wearing any clothes!" And he suspected the little boy was right. But the duplicitous weavers had disappeared with their loot. He had an empire to run. So he drew himself up and continued to parade. His courtiers continued to hold up his non-existent train. We don't know what happened to the little boy who cried out that something was really nothing.
I suspect he went off and studied physics and scored $70,000 a year by the age of 40. Shelley Gair's scintillating book is called The Triumph of the Airheads, Park Street Press. Next week, Tony Barter from La Trobe University takes another look at Charles Darwin and the rise of the master race. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.